Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, on air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet. I'm Ruben Stern. This month, a small art gallery in Columbia is showcasing an interesting set of paintings. The abstract compositions present the viewer with vivid swaths of color that move up and down and across and around. They are bright and lively and full of energy. And while the artwork itself is something, a really interesting part is the story behind the paintings. They were done half a century ago in St. Louis by an artist named John Wiemer, and then promptly stashed away. They've basically been in hiding ever since. The story of how those paintings wound up in Columbia, which you'll hear today, sounds a lot like an art collector's urban legend. One of the seemingly mythical factors is that, as far as the influential people in the art world knew, paintings like these came from New York, not from here. So, separate from the merits of the work, this set of paintings calls to mind some larger questions about art in general. First, how does an individual painting morph from being an obscure thing that an artist created a long time ago into something significant in the world of art collecting? And secondly, at what point did, or perhaps will, the Midwest factor prominently into the larger thing we call American art? Here to help us explore the Midwest's place in that larger art context, first of all, Melissa Williams is the owner of Melissa Williams Fine Art Gallery here in Columbia. She is the main reason that John Wiemer's paintings are on display. Welcome to our program, Melissa Williams.
Pleased to be here.
Glad to have you with us today. We also have with us today Jennifer Perlow. She is the owner of PS Gallery in downtown Columbia. Her gallery displays the work of many current local and regional artists. Welcome to our program, Jennifer Perlow.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming into our studio. We also have in our studio today Joan Stack. She is the curator of art collections at the State Historical Society of Missouri. Welcome back to our program, Joan Stack.
Oh, well, thanks a lot.
Thanks for being here. And we also have a guest on the phone. Joining us on the phone is David Houston. He is the former curatorial director at the Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art. He left the museum earlier this year to become the director of the Beau Bartlett Center at the Columbus State University in Columbus, Georgia. Welcome to our program, David Houston.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you with us. We hope to hear from you in our audience as well. Do you have a favorite Missouri or Midwestern painter or artist? If so, tell us about it. We'd love to hear. So give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. And let's start with this. Melissa, please, tell us the story of how Wiemer's paintings ended up in your gallery.
Well, I was lucky enough to hear about him and hear that he was an incredible painter and a fascinating guy to talk to. And I called him with no idea that he still had his work from the 1950s and 60s. And I guess once I got there, he gradually admitted he had them and then gradually showed them to me and then gradually let me take them for sale.
And what does that mean, gradually, step by step through there?
Actually, he sort of fell off a cliff after a certain point. He decided he's 85, and this was his chance to see things exhibited again. I told him I could exhibit them here and do a catalog and hopefully exhibit them in Chicago and New York as well.
And why did you seek him out? What about him is interesting in terms of wanting to show his paintings to somebody?
Well, the history of Missouri art, other than Bingham and Benton, is completely obscure. There's no books about it. There's really very few articles. And if you want to learn about it, you have to talk to older people who knew artists or went to shows and gallery shows. So it's just a verbal history. It's a secret history at this point. So I'm very interested in art that was produced at the middle of the century, and so I called and asked if he would talk to me.
Right. And how did you find him? It's obscure. You know about these things that other people don't know. How did you land on this particular artist?
He was the last living one from that era, basically.
Wow. It seems like the dream come true of somebody who represents art. Jennifer, would you agree with that?
Certainly. You know, Melissa and I deal in completely different realms. I'm dealing with artists who are currently producing And she's usually dealing with people who are, you know, she's dealing with works that are a little bit older and have been produced some time ago. So you certainly couldn't have a better scenario for somebody in Melissa's position than stumbling onto or seeking out, uncovering, unearthing a gem like this. And to have that kind of cache of works available is pretty amazing.
Right. And Joan, how important is this in terms of, you know, Missouri art generally?
Well, I think any time we can rediscover an artist who and who has an important role to play in the national scene and the national art represents national art movements from Missouri, that's always a really important find. I think I was talking to Melissa about how in some ways I think Missouri is a microcosm of the nation, but rarely recognized as such. So we find all kinds of things going on here that surprise a lot of people.
And what do you mean a microcosm of the nation? In what ways does Missouri fit that?
Well, Missouri is neither northern or southern, eastern or western. It doesn't fit neatly into most of those regional categories. Sometimes we consider ourselves Midwest, but sometimes we're grouped with the Southerners. It's really difficult to categorize Missouri and Missourians, and I think we often have a split identity, and we have an understanding in Missouri, a lot of our cultural figures do at least, of aspects of all these different regions. And so I think this is a great example of how the abstract expressionist movement is manifested in a Missouri artist, and people might not have expected that.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. Why is that important that a person like John Wehmer painted abstract paintings around the middle of last century?
Because that would have been, well, it would have made him part an artist who was part of an international conversation at that time. The people all over the world, they were taking their lead from American artists, but they were really addressing this way of going completely abstract, and yet very visceral paintings, paintings that don't need interpretation to understand. And New York likes to claim that they did it. And so the idea that other people in different parts of the country were also painting like this is kind of new concept for people.
Right. Are there other ways that Missouri is a microcosm? I mean, this is one example. Joan, what other ways does Missouri represent in terms of specific types of painting or painters?
Well, one thing I think is interesting that the New York scene might try to forget, though there has been some work on this recently, is that the great Missouri painter Thomas Hart Benton was, of course, the teacher of Jackson Pollock, who himself came from Wyoming, not from New York, but makes it in New York. So we're actually seeing an art that's very American, not coming out of the East Coast, and maybe that's why it has such power. Pollock will talk about his Native American influences, about all kinds of things besides the great European modernists. And though Pollock didn't speak a lot about Benton as an influence, the movement, the energy of Thomas Hart Benton's painting is clearly reflected in what Pollock is doing. So we actually are seeing a very strongly American quality to abstract expressionism, perhaps rarely recognized.
And that's a really interesting, hard connection for people to extrapolate given what's in the paintings, right? I mean, Thomas Hart Benton's paintings are very representational, and you can see people and scenes and things we recognize. Pollock's just a lot of sort of paint dripped all over the canvases, right? It's a weird connection.
Well, you know, Benton is always talking, when he talks about his art, about the formal qualities, about the importance of rhythm, about the importance of shape and line and the composition all working together to create a certain energy. Movement was very important to Benton, and that's something that really appears in Pollock's work. And there's some really interesting ways of looking at some of Pollock's work where you can see the rhythms and how very similar they are to Benton paintings. He often will have these strong currents in his work that are very Benton-esque.
Okay, I want to remind everyone, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the place of Missouri and the Midwest in the larger context of American art. Joining me in the studio are Melissa Williams and Jennifer Perlow, who both operate art galleries in Columbia, and Joan Stack, curator of art collections at the State Historical Society of Missouri. Joining us by phone also is David Houston. He is the former curatorial director at the Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art. For those of you in our audience, what comes to mind when you think of art in Missouri? Share your impressions. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. And we'd like to remind you that Intersection is broadcast live every Monday at 2 online at kbia.org and also on the radio. You can be part of our conversation at that time by going to our website and watching our video stream. That's at kbia.org. You can also follow the link for Intersection off that website, and that will get you to our live online chat as well. David, I want to bring you into the conversation. We've been hearing some very Missouri-focused ideas about this, and I wonder, how does this fit in with your view as somebody who works or formerly worked at a very national and international kind of museum?
Well, I think the idea of Missouri being kind of a microcosm of the largest state of American art is just right, because the history of American art has yet to be written. What we have are a series of fragments written largely along the rims of America, along the East and West Coast, where there are vigorous markets, where there are collectors, but many artists, quite important and interesting artists, have worked all across the country. And if you think about it, the history of European art is old. People started writing about it back during the Renaissance, and it has several centuries of distinguished history behind it. But as a country, we're relatively new in terms of European art. And American art as a discipline and a field of academic study is relatively new. As recently as 15 years ago, there were very few departments of American art at universities, and only recently do we see museums and institutions interested in it. So we have a long way to go, and the history of the Midwest is a part of that history we've yet to write.
Right. And, you know, is it, you know, are the artists from the Midwest given their due when it comes to these kinds of conversations about art? I mean, you know, there are a couple of notable people out of Missouri that may or may not be recognized as Missouri artists.
Well, you have a distinguished group of people that have taught and have been students at the Art Institute there, and often they filter into the history of American art in other places and other ways. But one of the things that's missing, and I think our other panelists have pointed to this, is the creation of a context of what is unique about Missouri, what is common about Missouri artists working in other places. And I previously also have worked in South Carolina, which is a state with along the East Coast, but it's in the South. And because of Charleston, there's been an interest in the state's art that has created collections and histories and a context. So if you look for information on artists in South Carolina, whether that's an internationally important artist like Jasper Johns or an emerging artist, there's a good bit of fabric about the context in which those artists emerge and work. And many parts of the country have yet to create that fabric and context for themselves. And I think it's something that everyone in institutions should be thinking about.
Right. Jennifer, this might be a good place to segue into the work that you do in terms of that question of how do you create that sort of place and art world within a place like Mid-Missouri or the state of Missouri?
Well, I think a lot of it is intention. You know, when I started the gallery several years ago, there was a lack, certainly locally, of a cohesive art community. And one of the things that I have tried to work with other people within the arts community to do is establish a real sense of self amongst the arts community, to provide an opportunity for people who are currently working in the arts to stay here and show here and be celebrated here. To give the public an opportunity to be vested in the arts community. And I think that's how you start to change this kind of ideal of this isn't a place that people will stay and show. This isn't where their work will be celebrated. This isn't where they'll be accepted and raised up and shown and unearthed and found and really reveled in. And I think we've had some success in doing that.
Right. And how much of that is you know, explains artists like Thomas Hart Benton or some of the other prominent artists from Missouri who, you know, who spend a lot of their careers elsewhere? Joan, maybe you can help us with that. I mean, is it that, you know, that they had to go elsewhere in order to be successful as artists?
I suppose that's true in both Bingham and Benton's case, but what's interesting about both of those artists is that they come back to Missouri and use Missouri as their subject matter. And going outside of the artistic world, another case where that happens is Mark Twain, who goes elsewhere, but then his greatest works, one could say, are coming back to Missouri as a kind of an inspirational place, a place where I think there is this kind of liminal space where things happen, things change. You can deal with, you know, these great issues of America, things like slavery and race, and some of these issues that America has been dealing with. Missouri is a place where things are not quite as codified as they are in other places. And
Melissa, would you agree that that's the case in terms of the artists in St. Louis throughout the century? I mean, it seems like if a painter was in New York, then a Missouri theme would seem a lot more exotic and interesting than if they were here in Missouri painting.
Right.
Is that true? I mean,
well,
does that play out?
My ideas are actually evolving while I'm listening, because I was listening to what David said about how difficult it is to look at works by Missouri painters and see something that is typically Missouri in them. And I think that that is really the case, that most of the good artists here saw themselves as part of the national scene, and they weren't contributing to a narrow image like that. And maybe that's why people don't have any concept of Missouri painters, because they didn't have a concept of themselves that way. And what Joan is saying about the geography, the river, well, both the rivers that run through the state maybe have added to the inspiration of the... Go ahead.
Well, rivers are liminal spaces,
are
spaces of limbo where you can move from slavery to freedom, from poverty to wealth. And I think in some ways that's what Missouri is sort of about. I often think that that's what Benton's mural in the Capitol is kind of about anyway, when he deals with the subject of Missouri and his great work that makes Missouri his subject matter. The river is an important part. He deals a lot with moving from being a state that's just being settled into an industrial place, and how the rivers play a role in that. And you know, so I think it's an interesting place.
And did that play out in his other paintings? Because the mural is in the state capitol. It's a whole room. It wraps around there, and it's supposed to be about the history of Missouri, which is a river state. Did his other works pick up that theme as much?
There are some that do. I would say, I'm thinking of, say, his lithographs that he produced. Probably about maybe a third of them maybe have a Missouri theme, or they could be a Missouri. Maybe over half would have a Midwestern theme of some kind or another.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer, do you see that in the works of the artist now? I mean, is there one way or another regionalist kind of spirit, or something that infuses their paintings to tie them together, or is it still...
I mean, I guess in my perspective, I deal with such a wide range of artists that I think you do a bit of a disservice to pigeonhole Missouri artists as, you know, using a regionalist theme, or, you know, connecting to a Missouri theme, or having some thread of Missouri through their work. Certainly there are some I can think of, like Nora Othick is a great example of kind of a neo-regionalist with, you know, nods to Thomas Hart Benton, but there are people who are doing, you know, complete abstractions that you wouldn't really be able to take a literal Missouri thread out of. I think part of what I want to have said today is we have incredible artists who are living and producing in Missouri, and they're producing everything from A to Z. And that's what we need to celebrate. It's not just the nods to Missouri, but that we really have incredible artists that are coming out of this state, and we need to find a way to make sure that they're recognized.
Well, David, let me ask you this. I mean, given what Jennifer said in terms of, you know, great artists around the state now, what Melissa has said about people having painted in all different styles in Missouri, why, when we talk about art in the Midwest, especially Missouri, are we only talking about two artists? we're talking about Thomas Hart Benton, and we're talking about George Caleb Bingham. And that's it. What happened?
Well, you're talking about artists that really, I mean, we used the word regionalism, and it was a real moment in time. And the regions themselves produced good artists, but they also became subject matter for other artists to come and celebrate and paint rural America. I agree. The artists that are working all across the country, you can go almost into any state and find vital artists that could show really alongside most other artists producing today. What they need are markets. They need critical attention with people writing about their work. They need people selling their work. And artists have to survive, and they tend to migrate to places where the infrastructure supports artists. And it sounds like that several of you there are thinking along these terms of how do we get artists seen, bought, and discussed, and that should be celebrated all across the country.
Okay. Once again, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the place of Missouri and the Midwest in the larger context of American art. Joining me in the studio are Melissa Williams and Jennifer Perlow, who both operate art galleries in Columbia. And we also have Joan Stack, curator of art collections at the State Historical Society of Missouri. Joining us by phone is David Houston. He is the former curatorial director at the Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art. For those of you in our audience, do you have a favorite Missouri or Midwestern painter? If so, we'd love to hear about it. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org, or if you have questions for our panelists, feel free to call in with those as well. In terms of the art that was happening in St. Louis, Melissa, you hinted that there's a secret history of art in St. Louis, and I would love to hear a few of those secrets.
Okay. Well, And I would like to agree with David that until we have publications about the state, it will always be a secret history. I don't know why we can't have more publications. I guess it always comes down to money or something. But anyway, the river brought the earliest painters. In the 1820s, we had painters coming through, not only portrait painters, but landscape painters, and they were looking for images of this incredible area that they could then make into prints and sell back east or even in Europe. But then it morphed into, you know, the Bingham and that imagery of the men on the river, especially, just electrified people around the world. And then as it continued, I don't know, I mean, the fact that Bingham taught for a while at the University of Missouri, you know, right here, very, you know, a few yards from where we're speaking, or the fact that at Washington University, just after the war, some really important American painters came through there. Philip Guston, Max Beckmann was teaching, Carl Holte, Arthur Osver. Names that people do know on the East Coast were there teaching, and then they taught a whole range of students that produced really top-quality work.
Interesting. Joan, anything to add to that in terms of the stuff we don't know about from Missouri art?
Well, you know, at the State Historical Society, we have a variety of different types of art, and one of the things that I think is often forgotten about are the great artists who have worked in more popular genres. We've got at the Society a large collection of editorial cartoons, and there were some really great ones in St. Louis. Daniel Fitzpatrick, who won the Pulitzer Prize twice, was a nationally recognized, very important, very influential cartoonist. And then Tom Engelhart, who's still alive, another really important editorial cartoonist. And that, of course, the age of the editorial cartoon, unfortunately, is seems to be waning with the demise of the newspaper. But there was some really great stuff being produced. And Missouri especially with Daniel Fitzpatrick, who I think was such an important national figure.
Right. What about, you know, some of the things that have happened art-wise? I mean, I can't help but think of the Capitol down in Jefferson City, which is filled with art, right?
Right.
But not necessarily people we know, aside from that one room that Ben did. And then the Rotunda always gets a good story from, you know, because it was imported from Europe to do that work. But what about all that other painting and the people who did that? Where are they?
And they just published a book with gorgeous pictures of these paintings and then forgot to identify who the artists were, even though they're all major St. Louis painters who produced quantities of gorgeous work. But they didn't bother to put their names under the
pictures. Interesting.
And
is there much known about all those painters who did
there
all that work?
There is. You can dig it out. The librarians in St. Louis and Kansas City kept clippings from the papers, and there are files that you can access. But other than that, and certain collectors, they collect this kind of material because It is, and the students who worked on the John Wiemer articles were amazed. This is not on the internet, but you can find it. And yes, they were famous, and many of them exhibited nationally and internationally.
Okay. And of course, there are some national figures like N.C. Wyeth represented in the Capitol, and John LaFarge, and some other. They did recruit some major American artists.
The Taos artists came.
Yeah, the Taos artists, Coos and. Or it's a cow. So. But there were a lot of really important painters who came in to work on that project. It was a pretty national project.
Right. Okay, we have some callers on the line. Some people have taken our request, and they have called in with their favorite painter. So let's go ahead and bring a couple people into the conversation here. First, we have Carol on the phone from Columbia. Carol, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, thanks for calling in today, Carol.
Of course.
So who's your favorite Missouri painter?
Well, I think of two. One of them is Joseph Orr, who lives in the Lake of the Ozarks area. I would say that his art is certainly reflective of rural Missouri. But probably my favorite Missouri artist is a man named Michael McClure, who lives in the Ozarks. He has a studio between Willow Springs and West Plains, Missouri. Mm-hmm. And does a lot of painting of rivers and streams of the Ozarks, landscapes, mostly oils with lots of texture. Some of them are almost, even though they are impressionistic, they also are in some ways abstract.
Right. And how did you become familiar with his work?
Well, I lived in West Plains for a while. And found out about his studio, and he has showings at regular intervals, and then there were a couple of shops in West Plains that carry his art, sell his art, and I think he was trained in California, but then came to the Missouri Ozarks. There's also a Mexican influence in his painting, and he shows in one of the major galleries in Santa Fe as well.
Well, great. Well, Carol, thank you very much for calling in with that.
Well, you're welcome.
I appreciate that a lot. We have another caller on the line who also wants to share a favorite artist. Lori from Columbia, are you with us?
Yes.
Okay, Lori, thanks for calling in today.
You're welcome. I was just going to mention somebody who's really famous, Charles Russell. I don't know if he ever was in Missouri, but I know he was all over the Midwest.
Uh-huh.
And I just really love his work.
And what is it about the work that you like?
Well, it looks like he had fun, and it was somehow easy. And yet, I like the way it tells stories.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And I like the way it pulls me in. I almost feel like the painting comes to life, and I can go right into it.
Well, great. Well, thanks for calling in and sharing that. You were getting some nods around the table here, so I'm going to hear from our panelists about Charlie Russell. Joan, why don't you help us out?
Well, I think it's interesting that both Charlie Russell and Frederick Remington do have Missouri connections and spent time, Charlie Russell, I believe, in St. Louis and Remington in Kansas City. And what I think is really interesting about that is they're both considered Western artists. If you're familiar with, those are those two artists that do all those wonderful cowboy paintings and the bronze sculptures of the cowboys. And for a while, they were sort of dismissed, but they're getting much more attention lately. But it really connects Missouri with the West. And I think we often forget, but certainly in the 19th century, Missouri was a Western state.
That is interesting.
And it was very much tied to the idea of the expansion of the West.
We're going to have to come back to that. First, we're going to take a break. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today, we're talking about the place of Missouri and the Midwest in the larger context of American art. Joining me in the studio are Melissa Williams and Jennifer Perlow, who operate art galleries in Columbia, Joan Stack from the State Historical Society of Missouri, and on the phone, David Houston from the Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art. We'll be back after a short break. And welcome back. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the place of Missouri and the Midwest into the larger context of American art. Joining me in the studio are Melissa Williams and Jennifer Perlow, who both operate art galleries here in Columbia, and Joan Stack, curator of art collections at the State Historical Society of Missouri. Joining us by phone also is David Houston. He's the former curatorial director at the Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville, Arkansas. For those of you in our audience, do you visit museums in other places, but not so much in our own region? And if so, why do you do that? Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. David, I want to just give you an opportunity to join back in this idea of Missouri and the West, because it's quite common that we think of Missouri artists going off to the East Coast art establishment, but that's kind of an interesting twist, the idea that we would be connected with Western art.
Well, Western art spans out in many different directions. And, you know, if you think about it, Tom Benton went to Paris to discover himself as a Midwesterner, and in some ways Benton connects Missouri art with the South as he traveled also through the southern United States. And back to some of the original comments, Missouri is a real crossroads. It's a place where Western migration, the way that the railroads came together there, and when I think of Missouri, I think, and being a Southerner, I think of it as the Midwest, but when I lived there in Bentonville, right on the border, it also felt more Western than I remember having thought of it when I visited Kansas City or St. Louis. So I think in some ways the art of Missouri is little known because you have yet to tell that story from your own point of view. And I know that the museums there make exhibitions, but publications are very important as you start to tell your story from your point of view rather than letting the East Coast, the South, or the West kind of define what Missouri and Missouri art is.
Well, let me ask you this as a follow-up to that. What would need to happen? I mean, when you say publications are crucial to that transition, what's the process there? What exactly happens after somebody publishes something about, say, a Missouri artist? So say, you know, this John Weimer catalog is published with those paintings. What happens that would then change thinking elsewhere?
Well, I've been fortunate enough to work on two large catalogs in South Carolina since the Second World War that takes individual publications in a bibliography and puts them into the larger weave of the fabric of the history of the state. There's artists that have stayed, there's artists that have moved elsewhere, and fleshes out the larger picture. I was able to do a similar thing in New Orleans and Louisiana. And having a focus on both how Missouri artists are uniquely Missourians, but also how they are not, and they fit into this larger picture of American art that's yet to be written, is important. So both looking inward and looking outward creates a context in which they can be seen in their own right, but not just seen from a local point of view.
Right. And what makes a compelling case in that regard? Like, you know, you worked with a museum that was looking at artists from across the country trying to assemble a collection that was, you know, a really solid collection of American art. What would make you want to have it in the collection?
Well, sometimes, John's work, it's an artist that somehow has just dropped through the cracks of history, and you see the images and they're compelling and you want to know more. But also their influence. So fleshing these ideas out about a person and their time and their relationship to other American artists is particularly important.
Right. And is there a way to assess that in the current art landscape in terms of people who are currently painting?
Well, the electronic world is doing that, and putting together exhibitions online, putting together physical exhibitions and linking it to the electronic world, it makes things much more accessible from far away so that you don't have to travel. And, you know, finding that link of how a digital world linked to an actual world is particularly important for all of us in institutions.
Right. Jennifer, I'm curious your thoughts on this question, too. In terms of people who are currently painting, how do you sort of evaluate the relative importance of one artist versus many others?
It's a tricky bit, actually. And, you know, I think Melissa and I both live in this world. Part of what we do is try to establish whether or not we feel this artist's work has, you know, in Melissa's case, a historical significance and merit on its own. And in my case, you know, there's not a lot of historical reference that can be taken, but do I feel like this work has merit, not just today, but moving forward? So a lot of it is kind of theoretical. You know, do you trust my judgment? Do you trust that I'm going to go out and I'm going to find people that are going to have relevance 10 years from now? You know, this is my challenge as somebody who shows contemporary works. You know, it's about what, if you feel like I have good judgment. Because if you don't, then you shouldn't trust me and buy works from me and know that they're going to be relevant moving forward. Either that or buy it because you love it, and then you'll always love it, and, you know, then it'll always have value to you. But it is kind of this weird esoteric kind of thing.
Right. Melissa, your thoughts on that?
Well, I was thinking that when David was talking, I think what really makes the case is if you get gorgeous, large color reproductions of a painter who's obscure, then they will be decided, because the art community will then decide from looking, unfortunately not at the work, but usually at the reproductions. But that's good enough for me. If we could get beautiful reproductions of our obscure painters, and if Jennifer could get beautiful reproductions of her contemporary painters out into a larger community, then let them decide. They wouldn't have to trust us anymore. I trust the art community to make the decision.
And there is a truth to that. I mean, it is, you know, people ask how you value work. Well, it's what the market will support. So, you know, somebody's successful when their work is purchased.
And how much of that success is the quality of the art versus the color of the images? I mean, just what Melissa said. I mean, how much do those two things weigh against each other in terms of the marketing aspect of the art versus the significance of it in terms of it being original or it being, you know, sort of influential or other things like that? Because it's an interesting point.
It depends on who you're marketing to. You know, for me, if I'm trying to market to people outside of this community, it's hugely important that I have images that really portray the work well, or there's no point. You know, if I have collectors in Dallas that are looking at my website at, you know, somebody's new images, if the images aren't good and they don't represent the work well, then that's not, you know, we're probably not going to be selling to people outside of this market.
Right. Joan, I'm curious your thoughts on all of this as somebody who comes at it slightly differently.
Yeah, it's hard. It's kind of hard because I don't come at it at all from a marketing point of view, except for to try to get our artwork known, where I agree that getting images out on the internet is very useful. But I think about one of the stars, or a group of paintings that are the stars of our gallery, which are these Thomas Hart Benton World War II propaganda paintings. There is no way anybody wants to put those up on their wall. So it's a totally different reason why these are important. They're important because when you step in and you look at those pictures, you are transported in a way back to 1942 and can experience the intensity of the emotions that people were experiencing at that time. They really have a lot to tell us about ourselves. And so when I look at artworks in our collection, I'm often looking for things that somehow reach out and help us to understand our history. So it's kind of a different thing that I'm looking at as an art historian.
Right. And David, how much do big galleries like Crystal Bridges think like Joan, as opposed to thinking some of these other thoughts in their acquisitions?
Well, in a larger museum, you're always thinking historically. You're not trying to break ground, make careers. What you're trying to do is to flesh out a large narrative of American art and find the artist of influence in that. Now, when you work in the realm of contemporary art, you are putting yourself on the line. And I think professionally, it's what we're all doing. We're saying that these artists are significant for this reason, and what we're creating is a dialogue. We're not necessarily telling people that, but we're suggesting that, and then they can decide for themselves if they find it something significant or not.
Okay. We've had a few more contributions of favorite artists, so I want to get through some of those. You too, if you're listening or watching, can call in with your favorite artists. Our phone number, 573-882-8925. Again, if you have a Missouri artist that's your favorite or other experiences with art in Missouri, we'd love to hear about it. I want to go to Bill. He's from Jeff City. He's on the line. Bill, are you with us?
Yes, I can hear you fine.
Great. Thanks for calling in today.
Yes, my favorite is Gary Lucy of Washington, Missouri. During the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial, he was a national artist that got a lot of exposure, and he's from Southeast Missouri State, and he has a mural on the great race down there, on the steamboat race on the Mississippi.
Mm-hmm. And what is it about his work that resonates with you, Bill?
Well, he has a studio, and I got to see him. Works in progress, and he's just a nice guy.
Great, great. Well, Bill, thanks for calling in today.
Thank
we
you.
Really appreciate your contribution to the conversation here. It's interesting, the idea of the connection with the artist, right? And Jennifer, you're nodding a lot here. How much of that plays into this as well in terms of being able to connect with the artist as a person?
In my world, that's huge. I mean, that's why I do what I do, because of the connection that I have had with artists. You know, you can see with Melissa and this show, you know, it was because of this connection that he decided to let her show the works, you know. And to me, that's what gets people engaged. And, you know, you've heard most of the callers related to this person's work, but really connected to it when they got to meet the artist and get to know who they were and what made this significant. So, you know, I hear David talking about us telling the story. So, you know, this makes me think that for us to successfully tell the story, we have to tell some of the personal connection as well as just the greater picture of the art and the artist, but the personal connections that these people had too.
Well, and Melissa, what was that like in terms of your personal connection with the artist, John Weimer?
So fun, because, you know, I could ask him these really hard questions. You know, why did you paint every painting differently? Because a lot of artists, once they find a great, they can paint a great painting, they just keep painting that same painting over and over. And I asked him, why do other artists do this, but you did a different thing? And he said, to tell you the truth, it is so hard to paint a good painting. You have no idea how it tears you apart. And most people can't go on doing that over and over and over.
In terms of creating a wholly new original
right.
thing. Fascinating.
Yeah, I was stunned.
But then he sort of did, though. I mean, he transitioned out of this style of painting into something completely different. Right,
he did.
And how common is that for artists to do that, to paint in a style and sort of create some successful works and then say, okay, I'm done, I'm moving on?
I don't know.
Well, there's great examples like Pablo Picasso, who did a lot of that, though we associate him with a particular style. He worked in many different styles. And, of course, you can see some of that going on in an artist like Michelangelo even. But I don't know. I think you have a little bit of both. I think you can be a great artist and sort of keep on in a similar vein, or you can do radically different things. I think it kind of depends on the temperament.
Interesting. And Jennifer, do you see this much?
I do. In fact,
we'll get David in after this.
One of the fun things about being in the gallery business for as long as I have been, my curator, Joel Sager, we've been showing his work since he graduated from college. And it's been really fun because every 3 months he does an entirely new body of work. And sometimes they are really similar, and sometimes it's a completely different vein. And there's a thread. I mean, I think almost without fail, I could turn my head and look at something and go, Joel Sager painted that. But they appeal to different people, and it really stretches him. You know, for him as a professional artist, he needs to be constantly challenging himself and really stretching and making sure that he can still paint, that he's not just painting what people want to buy, but that he's continually pushing himself as an artist. And that's fun to watch.
Right. David, your thoughts?
Well, in the mid part of the 20th century, consistency was something people really valued, because there was a real common idea about what art, good art is, and what it should be. And from pop art on, the kind of rapid change in the world caused the artist to think about things in multiple points of way. So it's not unusual for artists his age to have grown into two or three different styles within their career, and that be seen as something positive rather than a disadvantage.
Interesting. And at what point does it become a liability for an artist that they get popular enough that they, you know, people know them for a certain thing, and if they start painting something different, does that ever become a liability?
I think certainly. You know, I can certainly think of somebody here locally that felt like they got boxed into a specific style, and you do have to be careful that you're not so consistent that you can't step outside of that box and do something else.
Right. Joan, you're nodding.
Oh, yeah, I think that that's definite. In fact, I was talking to Nora Othick, who you mentioned, who is very popular for her her things that have the strong Midwestern subject. But she does other things as well. But she was telling me when she goes to these big art fairs, they want her to keep everything kind of in the same style so that it's very consistent and they have this idea of what her work looks like. But she continues to kind of play around with that and challenge people. But in some cases, when she's trying to sell, say at an art fair, she's more conservative.
Right. Again, I'll remind everyone that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the place of Missouri and the Midwest in the larger context of American art. Joining me in the studio are Melissa Williams and Jennifer Perlow, who both operate art galleries here in Columbia, and Joan Stack, curator of art collections at the State Historical Society of Missouri. Joining us by phone also is David Houston. He's the former curatorial director at the Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville, Arkansas. For those of you in our audience, we have a few minutes left if you'd like to join our conversation, share your experiences with art from the Midwest, or ask questions of our panelists. You can give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org or go online to kbia.org, follow the link for Intersection, and join our online chat at that website. A couple of other sort of current artists that are favorites have been brought in from our audience. One of them, Billy O'Donnell. We actually had him on the program last spring, I think. Did an ambitious project where he went around and painted from all the counties in Missouri, which is like 149 counties plus St. Louis, I think. Interesting figure in Missouri art today. Jennifer, I'll throw it to you first because you've actually shown some of his paintings, right?
We have. We did an exhibit of Missouri waterways in November and December. And I think, you know, Billy O is really getting some national recognition at this moment, which I think is great for him, and I think great for Midwestern artists in general. He just won a national award in Laguna, California, had a huge show in Hawaii right after we showed his work, and almost sold out of the works there. And he is a Midwesterner. You know, when you talk to him, he's just got this really even-keeled sensibility, super nice guy, but really passionate about what he does. And, you know, again, real similar vein to some of his work, but he keeps kind of stretching and pushing himself and trying something new and different. And I think that that's important. And I think, you know, he has a real place in the sense of history moving forward with right. Missouri painters.
And has he put effort into getting his paintings to the coasts or to other places where art supposedly happens? I mean,
Certainly, I think he tries. I think, you know, one of the reasons there are galleries is because artists inherently are not great at promoting themselves. You know, and I say that not as a blanket statement, but, you know, as a rough generality. You know, they're not great marketers or promoters. And that is maybe why some of the Midwestern artists weren't as well known, because they weren't capable of getting themselves out of the Midwest and onto the coast to promote themselves and to promote their work.
Right. Help us understand that relationship between gallery and artist. Melissa, maybe you could help with that since you're in the middle of that right now, right?
Yeah, that's a big topic. But, I mean, it is really true that an artist who is with a strong gallerist becomes much better known, and their fame survives their death, and the gallerist makes sure that paintings get loaned to museums and, if possible, gets them under the nose of an art historian who can then publish about them. But on the other hand, gallerists can do a bad thing and narrow an artist's output by encouraging them to do a winning picture over and over again.
It sounds a lot like an agent in Hollywood.
Maybe so. Yes.
David, I'm curious your perspective on that in terms of, you know, who goes to bat on behalf of the artist.
Well, if you think about an art infrastructure, an artist producing a gallery being the middle person, and then either the consumer, whether that's an individual or an institution, all play a role in this sort of infrastructure. So one of the problems that regional artists have is they produce a lot of work and they have a hard time finding consumers for it, whether it's an institution or an individual. And dealers and writers and critics play a very important role in that. So artists that live outside of major metropolitan areas do a good job of finding those things for themselves, or else they have a lot of paintings back in the studio.
Well, I mean, what advice would you have for artists that are outside of the major art centers in that regard?
Find a good gallery, find representation both within and outside the region, and try to make themselves as visible as possible to others. And that's not easy for many artists.
Right. Would you agree with that, Jennifer?
It is very difficult. I mean, I think, you know, being in the art world at this moment in time is challenging no matter where you live or what you do. But certainly for artists in smaller communities, it is challenging, although I will say I do think that our recent economic crisis has caused people in smaller communities to kind of rally. I do see kind of a return to a sense of family values and local, shopping local, supporting local. And certainly within the Columbia community, I have seen a huge commitment to the arts community from our general public. And it's heartwarming to see, you know, and it really gives me hope that that we won't just survive this economic crisis, but we will come out of it really thriving.
Interesting. I want to come back to something you just said, but first we've got a caller on the line. Mike from Mexico is with us. Mike, are you on the phone? Okay, Mike, thanks for calling in today. You had a question?
Yes. I've got two paintings that have been handed down in the family. One's an oil. I'm sure it's 1880s or earlier, and I can't see any signature on it. And the other one is a pastel by William Chandler. I wanted to get an appraisal, but also wanted to get, like, the oil painting cleaned. Where's a good place to get that done?
A good question. I'm hoping somebody at our table will know that.
That's a really difficult thing to have done. You're probably going to need to go to one of the big cities, St. Louis or Kansas City. There are not a lot of people who do restoration and cleaning, and you really want somebody good. You may even have to go to Chicago.
And how would somebody go about tracking that down?
Well, you'll have to I would go online and do some Googling. It's not an easy thing, even for professional people like us.
Right.
We're often struggling with how to get something restored. And it can be kind of pricey, too. So,
right. And is that the
appraisal? Is that the same thing for the appraisal?
There are people around who do appraisals. You might be best, again, looking online, looking in the Yellow Pages. Sometimes the appraisal, if the artwork is not extremely valuable, you might be better off not getting an appraisal because the appraisal could cost more than the artwork is worth. So keep that in mind.
Interesting, interesting.
All right, well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling in, Mike. And for joining our program today. I wanted to come back to something you said, Jennifer, the idea of the community rallying around the art that's being produced in our area. Because one of the things that came up in a lot of the conversations in Columbia is Columbia as an art center to help drive tourism, because people tend to, I mean, the conventional wisdom is that people tend to buy art when they're somewhere else. They don't buy it at home. And I wonder if you could speak to that a little bit. I mean, is that in fact what you see, that people from other places tend to buy a lot of art and our residents tend to buy it when they're on vacation somewhere else? And
I think certainly in the past that has been true, that a lot of the people who maybe collected in town, who were collectors, would maybe collect their work from outside of this community. I think that's certainly changing. I think we've highlighted some of the value of the artists in this community, and people are sticking closer to home and buying closer to home now. I think it's just ease. You know, when you're on vacation, when you're out of town, that's when you have time. So I don't even know that it's necessarily a conscious thing. Like, I'm sure for some people it's a conscious thing. I'm going to go out of town to buy art. For most people, it's, this is when I have time to look. Look, my partner and I are together right now, and we're at this gallery, and we're seeing things together. Whereas when you're home, you're busy, and you're shuttling kids, and you're doing this, and you're doing that, and you're at the grocery store. But I will say I have noticed change, and I think that there is a greater consciousness in our community about making sure that we're supporting our local arts. And I think that's buying art. I think it's giving to the museums and the Columbia Art League and showing up. You know, that's part of my big thing is you got to show up. You know, you got to be a part of it. You have to have the intention of supporting the arts in whatever way you can.
Right. Okay, we have another caller on the line. Claire from Herman, are you with us?
Yes.
Great. Claire, thanks for joining our program and for calling in today.
Okay, thank you. I just had a comment. I'm sorry, I have a bad echo on my phone.
Oh, sorry about that.
It just seems to me that Missouri has something of an inferiority complex. I know that's true in St. Louis, but the need to have works of art, whether architecture or painting or photography, validated by external sources, primarily the East or West Coast, and perhaps through education and exhibits such as what's going on now that can help to alleviate that situation.
Okay, well, thanks for that comment. We're going to talk about that a little
okay.
bit, and I'll let you go because of that echo on your phone. I don't want to keep you online for that. But thank you for calling in with that. And let's put it to our panelists. Melissa, maybe you can be the first on that. Missouri inferiority complex?
Well, I certainly agree that we are looking for validation. And if I could say one thing on the program, I would encourage people that if you see work of, and there is a publication, that if you buy it, you are contributing to the conversation because that encourages people to do more publications. And then the work gets out on a national scale and we can hear what people think of it.
Interesting. Joan, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, that reminded me that we recently did a publication on an artist by the name of Fred Geary, who was a printmaker in Kansas City, but also based in Carrollton, Missouri, really of a national quality in the 30s and 40s and really not very well known. And so hopefully our publication will do some good in getting his name out there because he can't make it himself known now, but I do think that there is this inferiority complex. I think even it shows in some of our museums where they don't necessarily at the State Historical Society of Missouri, we do emphasize those Missouri artists, but at some of the other big museums that show, you know, international art, they sometimes are a little bit embarrassed by our Missouri artists. I'm not quite sure I get that, but
unfortunately, we are going to have to stop there. That's it, all the time we have for today. I'd like to thank our guests, Melissa Williams, Jennifer Perlow, Joan Stack, and David Hewson for joining us. We'd like to remind you that those of you that are enjoying this as a rebroadcast, that our program takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday. You can join us each Monday afternoon by listening to KBIA or by going online to kbia.org. Following the link for Intersection there, you'll be able to watch a video feed of the program, submit your questions and comments, and participate in an online chat with others in our audience. You'll also find a video archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. You'll also find some links to some of the artwork that we've talked about today, so if you go online and check that out, you can see some of those paintings. Today's program was produced by Raymond Tungekar, Vanita Rizvich, and Jessica Reese. Travis McMillan is our technical director with assistance from Eric Stazak, Pat Akers, our audio producer. I'm Ruben Stern. Thanks for joining us.